No.
Charlie, I don't know why they just
probably... Let's open our Bibles to Acts, the book of Acts, chapter 17. Book of Acts is right after the Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Acts. You should have been there already. Yeah.
You know Dean.
Yeah, sometimes I wish I didn't.
Don't we all.
Acts 17. Verse 21, Acts 17:21. Now all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling and or hearing something new. And Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. Now, this word religious is not religion in a good sense, but it's religion in a bad sense. It basically means reverent to a deity. Reverent to a deity. So it doesn't mean religious as we oftentimes use the word religion. Oh, he's a very, you know, spiritual, religious, godly person. It does not mean that. The word in the Greek is deisidaimon. Yes. DEISIDAIMON. And it means, again, reverent to a deity. King James Version says, too superstitious. Uses the word superstitious. Okay. And, of course, if you have a false deity that you are obliged to or that you are reverent to, then there is obviously a lot of superstition involved with that.
Don't let them in. Do they know the right
knob? Password. Okay.
Hey, there he is.
And pause on the tape. That's all right. Anyway, notice it says very religious in all respects. And it simply means that they had a lot of devotion to various deities, various gods. And there were an abundance of gods and deities that the Greeks and the Romans worshipped. Of course, we're talking about the Roman culture primarily, but the Greek culture had been absorbed by the Roman culture at this time. And now he explains why or how he knows that they are very religious. And he knew it all along, but he's going to apply it specifically to them in verse 23 for anyone. He says, For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, all these idols, I also found an altar with this inscription, To an unknown God. They have an altar there to an unknown God. Now, this is part of their superstition. They want to cover all the bases. They don't want to offend any of the gods. So just in case they left somebody out, they have this altar there. So they're not going to bring on the wrath of any particular god, quote unquote, because they have, well, we've acknowledged him, we just didn't know your name, so don't get mad at us. Paul continues, What therefore you worship in ignorance, this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. I'm going to tell you about this unknown God. I'm going to tell you about the God that you know nothing about. You know nothing about him simply because you're so involved with all these other gods who are indeed false gods. Verse 24, The God, not a God, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Neither is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all life and breath and all things. What they did with these idols, and all throughout the history of idolatry, they did this. They would bring food to the idol, and they'd put it there at the foot of the idol, expecting the god to come down and consume the food. And of course, in many superstitious cultures, they actually believed that at one time fire came down and consumed the food. They made idols out of trees. They would go out in the forest, and they'd chop down this tree, and they'd trim it nicely. They'd carve into it something. Then they'd take it into their city square, and then they would prop it up with other sticks and things so it wouldn't fall over. And then they'd say, "You are my creator." Oh, starting to fall. Support it over there. "You are the one who made the heavens and the earth. You are the one who brings us all things. Look out, it's starting to fall there." And of course, it cannot speak, it cannot hear, it cannot move. And they are worshiping it as a god. And this is the kind of mentality that is involved with idolatry. The god does not dwell in temples. They made little sanctuaries and temples for all of these things as well. And this is not to demean the Jewish temple that was made and designed by God, but that's another story, which is not my subject tonight. But he does not dwell in temples made with hands. Neither is he served by human hands. That's a reference to the idea of bringing all these foods and stuff down to the idols. As though he needed anything. See, the God doesn't need anything from your hands. He doesn't need, what did Cain bring? Remember Cain's big mistake? He brought all his veggies. He thought they were the best in the world. They probably were. Problem is, God didn't want his veggies. God wanted a different mode of worship. He wanted a recognition of his own authority. He wanted recognition of his own policy that he laid down. He didn't want somebody changing the rules. That's what man has done all along, is change the rules. God is the one who sets the policy. God says, "This is the way I want it done." Man is stubborn. Man is self-centered. Man doesn't like the way God does things. Man is impatient. Man sometimes thinks God should have done something yesterday, and of course it's way beyond yesterday, and so they're impatient. So they design their own ideas and their own mode of worshiping God and make up their own gods. As Paul wrote in Romans, hold your place there, please, and turn to Romans 1, which is right after Acts. Romans 1:18, Paul writes, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress or resist the truth in unrighteousness." Why? "Because that which is known about God is evident inside them. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." Since the beginning, the evidence of God is clear through the physical universe. We can see an evidence of God. Of course, not all men will recognize the evidence of God through the physical universe, and they try to explain it away. They try, "Well, no, that didn't come from God, that came from a big bang. That just happened all of a sudden. No, man wasn't created by God, man evolved." And all the various ideas that man comes up with to try and explain their existence and to explain their purpose in life. And yet, the physical universe actually proclaims the fact of a creator. Because if anyone wants to objectively and honestly look at it, there's only one explanation. And that is the fact that there is a designer and there is a person, a God, who brought that design into being. Continuing at verse 21, "For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God." And by the way, this knowing of God is an awareness idea. Not saying they had a relationship with God, but they had an awareness of God. Even though they knew of God, obviously by seeing the creation, They did not honor him as God or give thanks. This is what God requires of us as members of the human race. He requires us to honor him as God. He requires of us to give thanks, which simply means to recognize that he is the source. Giving thanks means we recognize God is the source of what we have. God is the source of our life. God is the source of what we have. But they became futile or empty in their speculations, reasonings, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. See, they actually thought they were wise, but in actuality, in their mindset, in their worldview, and in their practices, they became fools. And they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over, turned them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them, and so forth. All I wanted to focus on at this point was the idolatry aspect of it. They turned away from the revelation of God that was clear in the physical universe, and they exchanged it. They found a pretty bird, and they worshipped it, and they made it their god, or a crocodile, an awesome creature, or a tree, or the sun, the moon, a particular star. And they made this their god, form of a man, form of an animal, form of a bird, form of crawling creatures, insects. The Egyptians worshipped the what?
The scarab?
The beetle, yeah. Scarab is a beetle. Okay, back to Acts 17. Verse 24, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, neither is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all life and breath and all things. There you have it. Paul is saying the God who is the God is the source. He's the source of life. He's the source of our breath. And he's the source of all things. What do those three things communicate to us? First of all, the source of life. He gives life to all. That is your existence. Breath to all refers to your continued existence. And all things refers to all the aspects of your life. All the possessions that you are able to acquire, all the things that you are allowed to do. All of these things, all coming from God, allowed by God, permitted by God. He is the source of our life, source of our sustainment of our life, and source of all that we have. Verse 26, and he made from one every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. He's the one who formed the nations, organized the nations, allowed the nations to move and migrate and immigrate into various areas and settle down. And he allowed these nations their boundaries and basically said, all right, you guys, here are some rules, here are some regulations, here are some moral standards. Follow these moral standards. If you don't, you guys are going to make a mess of your life. And what's the reason for this separation of the human race into separate societies or national entities? Verse 27. So that they should seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. What this communicates is that God designed for the human race to exist in separate societies so that there would not be one ruler over all the human race. If there was one ruler over all the human race, then you would have a greater tendency for enslavement. Enslavement also affects your free will. It affects the dissemination of the gospel message, the proclamation of God and the provision of a Savior for the human race. And so God separated these nations into these various segments so that there would not be any restriction on their seeking God. If there was a one world government and there was a despot, a dictator in control of this, then he would restrict the people from seeking God. Now, he cannot stop what you think, but he can stop the spread of the gospel, for example. He can restrict it, I should say. He can't stop it, but he can restrict it. So you have different societies, and each society is responsible itself for its understanding and allowance of moral and spiritual truth to be manifested within that society. So he did this so that they should seek for God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. He's available to all, is what Paul's saying. Now in verse 28, for in him, here's why they need to seek God. For in him we live and move and exist. Even as some of your own poets have said. Now he quotes some of these Roman poets. Quote, for we also are his offspring. Now by using the term offspring or offspring of God, the issue is creation status. Okay? It's saying that God is the creator. It's not saying that everyone is a child of God. That's different. Not everyone is a child of God. There is a philosophy, a worldview that's going around that basically can be summed up by the terms the universal fatherhood of God and the universal brotherhood of man, saying that we're all brothers and we're all children of God. Well, the Bible does not teach that. The Bible teaches that you only become a child of God by accepting God's authority over your life and entering into a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, God's Son. That's the only way you become a child of God. Jesus himself said you must be born again, born into the family of God. When you are born into the family of God, you leave the family of the world and you become a child of God. And that's the only way to be a child of God. But this is talking about the fact that we are all creatures of God. And what Paul's point here is to recognize that, well, since we are all creatures of God, since he is the creator, then we certainly, logically, reasonably, should owe him something. Isn't that reasonable? Since God is your creator, he is the source of your life, that you should owe him something. And he's not going to settle for a five spot. He wants something a little bit more serious than that. He wants your mind. He wants your recognition. He wants your reverence, and he wants your love. But he's not going to force you. He's not going to twist your arm behind your back and say, if you don't love me, I'm going to twist this until it hurts. And you say, ouch, 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 okay, I love you, God, I love you. Fine, thank you. Does the guy really love God? No, he said it because it hurts. No, God wants love that comes from the free will. Comes because we recognize who God is and we've learned to appreciate him and respect him and regard him and then love him. God could have created a bunch of robots if he'd wanted to that would be programmed to love him. Push a button, I love you, God. And God would sit back and say, oh, I'm happy now. I got people who love me. No, they're programmed. So the love is false. The only love that God wants from his creatures is a genuine, real love that comes from free will. And that's what Paul is communicating here. He says in verse 28, quoting the prophet, we are his offspring. Then in verse 29, being then the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Since we are the offspring of God, We certainly should not think of him as a stone, as a piece of gold, as a tree, something that is impotent, without power. How can I reasonably say, my creator? Oh, don't let it fall down. I can't. And yet, man does. Where's the logic in it? That's the whole point. There's something within man. There's something in man that influences him in the area of pure D non-logic, if that's a proper term. Stupidity. Okay? That brings his focus always back to himself instead of on God. And yet God is there pleading, always reaching into the human race, to every individual saying, you know, I'm your creator. You owe what you have to me. Now, why don't you give me what is my due? I don't require too much. I just want you to recognize me as God. And why? Because I love you, and you've got a problem. And if that problem doesn't get solved, I cannot have any kind of fellowship or relationship with you. I want you to live forever with me because I'm your creator. I want you to love me, and I want to love you, and I want you to worship me, and I want to bless you. But I cannot do that if you don't want me to. So I'm leaving the choice in your hands. This influence or nature within us that causes us to operate illogically is a sin nature. It's a nature that expresses itself consistently independent from God, and instead focuses entirely on what is beneficial to me. What's helpful to me? In other words, pure D, self-centeredness. And that's what keeps us out from relationship with God. We're all born that way. Maybe some of you have heard the term, we're born in sin. We are. We're born with this sin nature. That's because Adam gave it to us. Nice guy. When Adam sinned against God, I don't know if you know this, but when Adam was placed in the garden in the beginning, he was perfect. He was sinless. But he did have something that accounted for the potential for sin, and that was free will. Again, God could have created an Adam robot, but he didn't. He created an Adam free moral agent and said, Adam, I got a job for you to do. I want you to love me. I want you to worship me. And here I got this beautiful garden for you. You can have everything you want. And here's a woman for you too. And he told the woman the same thing. I want you to worship me. I want you to love me. And here's everything you need. Here's a man for you. Of course, they both looked at each other and went the other direction. No. But everything that you could possibly want is here. But I do have a job for you to do. There exists in this universe evil, darkness. And it hasn't always been that way. He taught Adam and he taught Eve, I created a very powerful and beautiful category of creature. I called them my sons. I called them sons of God. The Hebrew, Bnei HaElohim. And these were beautiful creatures, and powerful creatures, and wise creatures. Later, they became known as angelos, or angels. Okay? They were created before man was created. But again, he did not create angel robots. He created angel free moral agents. And he wanted from them the same thing, voluntary love and worship. But whenever you give someone free will, whenever you give someone the choice to love, to worship, there remains always the potential for that person to say no to you. There always remains that potential for him to say, well, I don't want to worship you. I want to worship myself. And that's exactly what happened with one of those creatures. In fact, it happened to be the most powerful, the most beautiful, and the most wise of all of those creatures. His name was, in the Hebrew, Heleel, which means shining one. That's the name God gave him, created him. Heleel, shining one, bright one, beautiful one. The Latin brought the Hebrew Heleel and translated it Lucifer, which in the Latin means shining one. Now, Lucifer is a wonderful name because it communicates the beauty and the brightness of this creature. There's nothing wrong with that name. But the individual, the angel, who was known as Lucifer or Haleo, got his mind on himself, got his eyes on himself. He was given a great responsibility among all the other angels, and it just went to his head. And he rebelled against God. He thought, you know what? Who needs God? I can handle this universe myself. I can take care of all these other angels myself. So he basically tried to present himself to the other angels as a new god and sought to displace the real God. Now, this was from the simple ability that he had or capacity that he had to choose. Once he made the choice, his whole angel soul became distorted. The Bible tells us that he corrupted his wisdom. He was created the most wise and beautiful of creatures, but he corrupted his wisdom when he rebelled against God. And this led to further and further and further distortion. And to this very day, he is still in rebellion against God, thinking to this very day that he can defeat the God of the universe. God has given him a little bit of leeway to do this, or I should say to try to do this. And I'll explain the reason for that in a moment. But in the process of this rebellion, Lucifer actually convinced one-third of all the angels to follow him. And in this rebellion, he thus became known as the adversary of God, the enemy of God. And in the Hebrew, the word for enemy or adversary is Shatan, which is now brought into the English as Satan. So that's where the word Satan or title Satan comes from. Lucifer was a good guy, but Lucifer became Satan after he rebelled against God. Satan means adversary or enemy. And as the adversary of God, he convinced one-third of the angels to come to follow him. Upon this, God said, you know what? You're in big trouble, dude, because you have rebelled against me, because you have manifested this darkness and this unrighteousness, I'm going to bring forth fire from you, and you're going to spend eternity separated from me in that fire. And Satan said, not fair. You love me. How can a God who claims to be a God of love, who claims to be fair and righteous, how can such a God, such an individual, throw his creature whom he loves in a lake of fire? It's not fair. It's not consistent. Satan didn't understand because Satan's understanding of God had become distorted and corrupted by his rebellion. And yet God's intent all along was for there to be a universe with creatures existing in it who would love him, who would worship him of their own free will. But in order for this to come about, he had to allow the violation of his righteousness. He had to allow a creature to sin. And then he had to allow that creature's sin to manifest itself in all of its ramifications, in all of its effects, in all of its negative repercussions. And then in the end, through all the years of the universe, including the history of the human race, show to all the creatures involved, this is the result of sin, and you can see that it is totally useless, non-beneficial, destructive, hurtful. Therefore, I'm going to judge evil, judge darkness, judge the creatures who refuse to worship me for all eternity. And from that time forward, the choice of evil will no longer be an issue. Why? Because it's been exposed. I've let it show its face. I've let it run its course. So it's not going to be an issue anymore. And if you really want to look it up, here, check out the Museum of Heaven. And you can look at the whole history of evil and see what happened. The first rebellion of Lucifer, all the way through the human race, how it was all done with, all the effects, all the ramifications. See? No issue. So that choice to do evil really won't be an issue for creatures in the future. And thus, God will have a universe populated by creatures who worship Him, who love Him, still with free will, but with never ever the inclination to rebel against God again, because such a choice, such a course of action has already been shown to be totally useless. So that's God's intent. So He said to Satan, I'm going to have to prove it to you then. You think I'm unfair? You think I'm unloving? I'll prove to you that I'm not only am I righteous, not only am I fair, but I'm also loving. And I can judge and love at the same time. So I'm going to create the human race. And so He did. He created the human race. Adam and Eve, He put them in the garden, perfect environment, gave them everything they needed. And He said, when you see man worshiping Me, a lower creation, inferior to you guys, when you see the human race worshiping Me, giving allegiance to Me, loving Me, then that'll prove to you that My way is right. When you see them handling all the various pressures of their finite life by trusting Me, then it will be proven to you that My way is right. So He put Adam and Eve in the garden. He gave them a job. He said, take care of the garden, number one. And number two, guard it. Guard it. You see this in the Hebrew of Genesis chapter 2, where it says, cultivate and keep. Well, now, when you're talking about a garden and you say cultivate and keep, is there really a difference between that in an agricultural sense? No,